Welcome to the About, From, and With podcast, a podcast showcasing speech-language pathologists' journeys to finding their passion and purpose in the field. I'm your host, Dr. Danica Pfeiffer. In each episode, we'll learn about, from, and with SLP clinicians and researchers as they share their experiences, advice, and expertise. Hi everyone, thanks for tuning in to this episode of About, From, and With. If you haven't already, be sure to follow the podcast so you'll be notified of new episodes when they come out. If you're enjoying the podcast, I'd love if you take a quick second to leave a rating or review. This'll help other people find it too. I'm so excited to share this conversation I had with the wonderful Dr. Tiffany Hogan about negotiations for faculty positions. When I was on the job market, I felt like it was so hard to find information about how to negotiate, so I really wanted to find someone who would be willing to share some negotiation tips from a faculty perspective on the podcast. I'm so grateful that Dr. Hogan was happy to share her experiences and advice. Dr. Hogan is a professor in the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders at MGH Institute of Health Professions in Boston, director of the Speech and Language Literacy Lab and the Center for Translational Research, Implementation Science, and Dissemination for Equity in CSD. She's also a research associate at Harvard University and inaugural research affiliate for the Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research. Dr. Hogan has published over 100 papers on the genetic, neurologic, and behavioral links between oral and written language development, with a focus on improving assessment and intervention in schools, especially for neurodiverse children with developmental language disorder, dyslexia, and/or speech sound disorders. Her advocacy for children with language, speech, and literacy disabilities has led her to co-found a DLD informational website, dldandme.org, host the See, Hear, Speak podcast, organize an annual conference in implementation science and CSD, and contribute information for articles in numerous news outlets, including the New York Times and the Boston Globe, along with several television and radio appearances. It was such an honor and a treat to be able to have this conversation and share it with all of you. Hi, Tiffany. Thank you so much for making time to be here today.
Thank you for having me. I think this is such a wonderful podcast and such a great service, especially to those who are starting out in academia.
Thank you so much. Let's start off with you just telling us a little bit about yourself before you started your academic journey and what got you into our field.
Yes. So when I started out as an undergraduate, I was in psychology and I was just very interested and curious about child development in particular. Just how babies go from kind of blobology to speaking sentences has always fascinated me. And I've always loved children. So when I first started out, I thought I would go into more clinical psychology and perhaps focus on even child psychology, child counseling. I kind of envisioned more of a counselor role. And then when I first started out and learned that you had to get the PhD, that really deterred me from getting the psychology degree because it felt like such a long-term endeavor, and which is ironic now considering that I did end up getting the PhD. But back then when I was 18, that seemed very daunting. So I started to explore different options, and my mother was a speech language pathologist, so I was aware of the field through her lens. She had worked in lots of different settings, but was actually working more with adults at the time. So I explored it a bit. And after kind of popping around majors, I came to speech language pathology, and I've loved it ever since. When I initially got my master's degree, I worked clinically in a children's hospital and also did some work in schools. Again, always focused on pediatrics. That's always been my specialty. When I was working in the children's hospital in Kansas City, Missouri, I was tasked with creating a parent training program for children who were on our waiting list for services to train them on early language stimulation, also early literacy, which was pretty avant-garde then. And I started looking in the literature and read Hugh Katz's book with Alan Kamai. And one of my colleagues encouraged me to reach out to him. And I did. I was starstruck. But I reached out to him and we started a dialogue. And before I knew it, I was his PhD student. And since then, I have completed the PhD. And then I looked at postdocs versus faculty positions. But I applied for both. But I ultimately took a faculty position at the University of Arizona for a few years, then moved to the University of Nebraska for 5 years. And then now I've been at MGH Institute of Health Professions for the past 10 years.
Great. And in that time, you just mentioned the different institutions you've worked at. What kinds of roles and positions have you had with mentoring students and working with students, and also any experience on search committees that might help guide our conversation today?
Yeah, I've had a lot of opportunities at those three institutions to be on search committees and also to mentor doctoral students. I've mentored numerous doctoral students over the years and postdoctoral fellows and helped them to negotiate their early academic career. And that's been a real honor of mine. And it's actually something that I knew I wanted to do even during the PhD program. And when I thought about places I'd like to work, I wanted to ensure that I'd be able to mentor PhD students and postdocs.
So that's awesome that you've had all of these experiences and you're willing to share kind of the other side of the negotiation process, which many are really curious about because negotiating positions in academia is really unlike negotiating positions in other fields, other industries. So let's jump in here and start with just an overview. So can you tell us, what is the negotiation process like for an assistant professor position, including things like when does it start and who do you negotiate with?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that there's always a bit of a taboo discussion about negotiations. And especially as an assistant professor, I find it to be very difficult to negotiate because you're in this vulnerable position where you're just so excited to have a job. And you're still a bit, I think, potentially having some imposter syndrome. You've just received your PhD or you've been in a postdoc for a little bit, but you're feeling just so grateful to have a position that it feels awkward to negotiate. And you kind of think to yourself, well, this is probably the best I'm going to get. And I'm so new. So who am I to negotiate? So I think that negotiation, even in my own experience, I felt much more comfortable negotiating as I had more time under my belt in academia. But I really want to highlight that you should always negotiate, even in the beginning, when you're getting that first assistant professor position, that's an important time to negotiate. So you asked me, when does it start and with whom? I think in terms of negotiation, it really starts with you as the applicant. And negotiation ultimately involves you being able to clearly communicate your needs. And that's going to happen even during the interview process. So if you send out your materials and you get the interview, you're going to be going on an interview. And you should at that time, ahead of time, really lay out, like, what do you need to be successful? And it's important to ask your mentor, your colleagues that have been through this process, and really lay out, what do I need to be successful? And then be ready to answer those questions. And so instead of considering the idea of just narrowly negotiating, it's really a conversation about what you need to be successful in that position. And that conversation can happen along the way in person in an interview. But the traditional sense is it often happens once you receive an offer. But it kind of starts during that interview process.
I like how you highlighted that you need to do your homework. You need to prepare. You need to talk to your mentor and really identify those things that you need to be successful going into that process. And you want to do that before you receive that offer, kind of have these things outlined before. I remember even in my second round interviews getting questions about that. What do you need to be successful? And I think the chairs and the department is thinking about that as they're interviewing you as well, is what kinds of materials, what kind of equipment you might need.
Exactly. And I think, too, that, again, back to the vulnerable position you feel you might be in when you're interviewing, especially for your first academic job, we have to keep in mind, and this is from my experience being on the search committee, I didn't know this when I was in my first position and negotiating my first position. What you learn from a search committee is that you'll get a lot of applicants, and the applicant pool is rich and can be large. And when you're chosen to receive an interview, it means you're really in the top. And it means that the search committee really wants you. So you are in actually a much better position than you think, because typically there's, you know, the search committee will choose 1 to 3 applicants to bring to campus. And it's very expensive and time consuming to bring applicants to campus. So if you've made that top 1 to 3, you are really in the driver's seat more than you think. You are really interviewing them. And I know you've talked about this a bit on your podcast, but I think that's important to keep in mind, because you should, when you're interviewing, assume that this could be a place that you are going to land. And if so, you want to make sure you've really thought through what you need, and also thinking through what the institute that you're interviewing at already has, and kind of how you would fit your work into that institute.
Yes, absolutely. Really need to do your research again ahead of time. Make sure you have all of this information so you can talk about it. Who are applicants going to be negotiating with? Who can they expect that conversation to be happening with?
I think during the interview, it could happen along the way, because keep in mind this idea that they really want you. So along the way, when you're talking to anyone during that interview, they could be gathering information, because they're going to be putting together an offer letter for you. So they're going to ask you questions like, you know, how much equipment do you need? What are you thinking in terms of your recruitment for your participants? What are you envisioning for your research time? They're going to be asking you all of these types of questions, because their goal is to get a really good offer for you. So you should be ready, like you said, prepared for answering those questions along the way, so they can start putting together a package. If the offer is made, you'll receive that offer. Depending on the program, sometimes the offer will come from the head of the search committee, but oftentimes it's coming from the chair of the department, potentially from the dean, but most of the time it's coming from the chair, is my experience. And so then they'll give you what's called either a soft offer, where they'll call you or email you and say, hey, we want to offer you the job. We're putting together your offer letter, or they could give you an offer letter. But regardless, that's the person you're typically negotiating with. And they are often serving as a bit of a middle person, because they're gathering what you need. And then they're often taking it to the dean or someone higher up in their institution to try to get the best deal for you.
Yes, that's really helpful. I didn't know about that soft offer process as I was getting started. And I even remember sometimes they would ask, are you interested in moving forward and seeing the offer? So before they would even present it, they wanted to make sure that I was still interested after that second round interview. And that's something I wasn't expecting either. So I think that's just good to be aware of, that there's kind of multiple phases here, and you're not going to get the offer in your email fully outlined from the start. It's going to be a process over time.
Yes. And I think the reason why, my experience has been, the reason why they do that is because to get an offer in writing that has every component you want, that takes some time on the chair's part. And it takes some negotiation on their end, because they have a budget that they're working with, and they're also trying to get the most typically for their applicant so that they can make a very competitive offer. So they want to ask basically, is it worth their time to move forward to start negotiating on their end for the best offer they can get? And they want to have some of those conversations, because then when they go to their dean, they will know what they need to add in terms of the finances. So it's helpful to treat them as almost like, at that point, your agent, that they're trying to figure out, you know, what you need to be successful. And it's just not known when you first start getting these offers and you're in this process. It's completely unknown that they also are negotiating for you.
Right. They're trying to help you and get you everything you need. For someone who hasn't gone through this before, they might be wondering, is this going to happen over email? Are they going to call me? Do I need to set up a Zoom session? What would you say? How does this usually start, at least? Is it usually a phone call, an email?
It really depends on the person. It can be a quick phone call. I really like to think through some of these things on email, because it gives you time to lay it out and lay out your reasoning, because the negotiation is really about your needs, and it's about describing why you need a specific, you know, aspect of the negotiation. So for instance, if you need a certain piece of equipment, but you know it's pretty expensive, it's important to really lay out why you need that equipment And sometimes I feel that you could do that better on email because it gives you a chance to really think through it and lay it out. And then it gives them the text they need to take it to the dean or to kind of work for you in that way. So I really like when it can be emailed to give you time to think about it and write it out. But sometimes it is on the phone, but you do have to remember, or a Zoom meeting, but you do have to remember that you're in the driver's seat. So if you feel pressured, like they're like, tell me now, you know, what I really need to know, what is your, you know, what are your equipment needs? Give me your budget. That can be very uncomfortable, but you have the right to say, well, I need time to think about that. Or you could maybe have a ballpark, but say, I'm really working on some of the details to give you some space and time around the negotiation.
Yes, definitely. That makes me think of, there was one offer that I received from a dean that called and said, we'd like to offer you the position. The salary is X amount of money. Do you want to accept the position? And that was all the information that I was provided. And I was just overwhelmed on the phone. That was, I think, one of the first offers I ever received. And I didn't really know how to respond to that in the moment. So I really appreciate your advice there to just say that you need to take time and think about it, because of course you're excited and you're grateful, but you need time to really think through a lot of things. This is a huge change. This is a big opportunity, and there's a lot more of the conversation that needs to take place.
Absolutely. You know, all honesty, my first position, I didn't negotiate at all. I really had that feeling of like, I'm just so honored to have this position. And I felt that when I received the offer, it was in person. It was a second visit because I said I wasn't quite sure. And in particular, my husband had never visited the area. So I was honest and said, I guess it was a negotiation. I didn't realize I was having a bit when they called to make the offer. And then I said, well, my husband's never been this area. We're really trying to think through that. We've, you know, and they said, well, we'll fly him out. So that was maybe a negotiation I didn't realize I was having. So then they flew him out. We came out for the second visit. I was given an offer letter at that time. And I think I was just so flattered and just so excited that I didn't even negotiate at all, which was a big mistake because I found out they had hired me, another person, and another person. So three at a time. And two of us had not negotiated. And the third one had negotiated and came in with $10,000 more in the salary, but had the same level of experience. It was really just an ask. And I didn't even think to ask. So that's something I also, I was excited when you asked me to talk about this, because I'm very passionate to make sure that students in particular who have not negotiated for an academic job before know that the first rule is always, always negotiate.
Yes. Yes. And I think some people feel just like you described, that you're so grateful, you know, you don't want to ask for more, and you're not sometimes not sure what other things you might be able to ask for. So let's talk about that. What are some things that applicants can ask for? You know, a lot of times they'll lead with, here's the salary. What other kinds of things might applicants be able to ask for?
That's a great question, because like you said, it almost seems like it's just based around salary. I will touch on one thing for salary, though, that I actually didn't realize, because I do think it is an important negotiation point, is that your salary is what everything is based on. That's really your starting point. So here's an example. You know, in that position I had where I didn't negotiate, but my colleague did, he started $10,000 more. So the next year when we had a 3% raise, then he had 3% of his $10,000 more raise. So he actually basically consistently for the rest of the career at that institution would get more in terms of his raises, because the base salary sets your raises over time. It sets, oftentimes can set your raise even as you get promotion and tenure. It also sets when you put in a grant, it's your salary in which you set your percent time, your summer salary, all of the additions. So the salary is key to try to push and get the highest base that you can for that salary, because it makes a big difference over time. The other components of negotiation are also critically important. So one is your time. So thinking about how much time you'll spend. So that, you know, you think of the traditional kind of research setting is a 40% research, 40% teaching, and 20% service. But those vary widely depending on the institution. And it can vary in your early part of your career to your later part of your career. So in your pre-tenure period, you might be able to negotiate more time for research, for instance, less time for service and teaching. But maybe you're at a teaching institution and you prefer to have more time for teaching and less time for research. You want to negotiate that, and that can be flexible. The other thing you can negotiate is your startup costs. So that's the money that's provided to you to set up your lab or to get yourself ready to do some research. And depending on where you are, it could be your money that you can use for extra training, for teacher training as well, to be a good instructor. And so you want to think about that as well. So your time and your money for your startup. And other than that, you can think about your moving costs. Those can be negotiated. And then there, it's kind of wide open from there. You can negotiate, depending on where you're going, some places will offer you even a housing bonus. People don't even think about this. You can say, well, the housing is super expensive. What is your flexibility in offering me funds for a down payment for a house, for instance, or money to offset my money to rent for a year so I can figure out where I'm going to be? There's just all of those kinds of possibilities that you can negotiate up front.
Yes, thank you. That's so, so helpful. I think a lot of people don't think about all of these other aspects. Something that you just hit on was the importance of salary, because this sets your base pay. And just like you illustrated for us, that difference gets bigger and bigger over time. I think a lot of people wonder how to approach that. So how can they negotiate for salary? What are some things maybe that they could say, or what are things that they maybe should research ahead of time so that they can enter that conversation and really be educated about where they can go and what they can ask for salary?
Yeah, that's such an important point. So you have to do your homework, always in negotiation, but especially with salary. So if you've been made an offer from a public university, you can get salaries off of usually the state website, because public universities should have their salaries publicly available because they're funded through public dollars. So you can start to really look and see, like, those, you know, if you know an assistant professor just came in the year before at that university, you can see what that person is making. You can look to see, what is the range of salary for assistant professors within that department, within the college, within the university. If it's private university, you can get, there are some think tanks that have pulled together salaries for different areas of study for private universities, and also based on location. So you can do that as well. And you can do your homework based on your cost of living as well. So you would expect to make more money in a place that has higher cost of living. So once you have that, you want to basically have a range in mind doing that homework. So you get a sense of what the typical pay is. You want to get a sense of the cost of living, and you want to try to shoot for an upper end to that. So you can, you know, let's say the range for a new professor in a certain area is $75,000 to $90,000. Then you should, and they've offered you $80,000. First off, you should know that they're always, always going to be offering you something that's at the low or middle of their range. They're going to expect you to negotiate it a bit higher, so they build that into their offer. And then you can say, you know, you want to say right up front, I've done my homework. This is what I found. And I want to go in at the upper range. And you could say, because I'm bringing this expertise, and I also want to start out on a strong foundation. So you'd want to say that. And then they'll typically kind of go back and forth a bit. Ideally, you'll want to be working with someone, and this is pretty true. I mean, I think it's rare this doesn't happen, but you're going to be working with someone who's going to be honest with you. So they can say, you know, things like, yeah, that makes sense. I can only go to, you know, let's say you're trying to go, they offered you, you know, it was 75 to 90. They offered you 80. You say, you know, I really want to get up to the higher range. I'd like to get it to 90. And they say, well, you know, with your years of, you know, you, this is your first position, years of experience, I think I can get you to 85. And then you say, you could push a little bit further. You could say, well, I prefer, you know, if we can get even closer to 90, let's go for 88. And then they might come back and say either 85 is the firm offer, or they could say, well, I could probably get you to 86. So you'll kind of come to a natural resolution as you go back and forth, but ideally they would be very honest with you about what they can get for you. And they're typically going to say things like, you know, I'm negotiating with the dean, or, you know, this is what we standard, you know, this is our standard. And you can just kind of keep pushing for why you'd like to have that to be a little bit higher.
That's so helpful. And how you're laying out kind of the words to use, I think, is really helpful too, because this is just such a new process, and knowing what to say and what's okay to say is really helpful. So thank you for laying that out.
Yeah, I can give another example. So I think this is not related to salary, but let's say it's related to equipment. Maybe you do some work where you have event related potentials and you really want to have that equipment. So you might say, you know, this equipment is $100,000 and this is really critical to the work that I do. And I think it's also part of why you hired me, because everyone was excited about this work. To get this work done, I need to have this equipment. They may write back and say, well, we actually have an ERP lab. You can access it there. And then you would want to say, well, I need to know some more details about, you know, how I'm able to access this, because I work with children and children can't be seen for this equipment until after school. So their range of time is usually 3:30 to 6 or on weekends. So can you tell me more about my access to that equipment? What would be my priority for that equipment? I really want to set myself up for success because I know that this is an area in which I can get funding. And to get funding, I need to be able to collect this data. So you always want to be negotiating with the end goal in mind, and that is setting up an environment that will make you successful. And that's what they want to.
Oh, that's so helpful. Hearing what you can say and how to put it in a nice way to really advocate for yourself, but also showing that you're willing to work with them and just need some more information to be able to make your decision.
Exactly. And then when you're negotiating too, you want to think about what is your priority. I mean, it's tricky because you're negotiating a lot of different factors. If we put them into big bins of like time allotment, salary, startups, and moving costs, I would also throw in support for teaching. So you could, you know, ask for a teaching assistant, for instance, or a graduate assistant to help you. But you can think about those different bins. You want to think about what's most important. I would say for most people, it is salary. So you can start tackling that first, perhaps, and put some weight on it. But once, you know, you don't necessarily want to say, okay, I have negotiated salary and now you don't have any time to negotiate anything else. You really want to be negotiating on all fronts and then picking your priority. And you can also use it to your benefit. So if they say to you, well, you say, you know, maybe you, and you need to do this, do a budget of what you want to make your research work for the first 5 years or so. And then they say to you, well, I know your budget's $100,000. We can really only give you $75,000 for this. That's a hard number. I really can't negotiate further. You can even say, okay, well, I appreciate that, but let's take a look then at salary and see if we can make some movement on that. Considering that you can't give me this, you know, startups that I want, what about salary? Or what if they say, you know, we can't give you startups you want, but we can give you an extra GA, which should help you with your data collection. So you can think about all of these components that you're negotiating separately, but you can use them to also leverage to get what you want more in one category if you can't make any progress in another one.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. I remember being given that advice too of like, don't try to negotiate everything, you know, whatever's in that initial offer. If there's five components, don't try to get more from everything. And just like you said, choose what is the priority to you and what maybe that's two or three different things, and then try to negotiate those. But don't necessarily just try to get more across the board.
And I think it's, yeah, I think that's great. And I think you also just have to truly be, you have to be true to yourself. So, you know, let's say you really come from a different position of negotiation. If you, for instance, let's say you're in a postdoc and you're offered a job, but you know you have another 1 or 2 years in your postdoc, and this maybe job is great, but maybe it's not your dream job. You're in a different position because in that case, for instance, you don't have to take the job. So you're really in a strong negotiating position because you want that offer to be fantastic for you to one, leave your postdoc, and two, go to a place that maybe you originally weren't super excited about. So you are in a different position. But if you're in a position where You don't have a job the next year lined up. This is your only offer. And this is a position in which you really want. Then you're first off, you still negotiate, but you're going to negotiate in a slightly different way than you would if you were in the other position. So you kind of know the levers you're pushing based on your position. But regardless of the offers you have or what position you're in, you always want to think about, how can I make myself successful? So if you even have your dream offer, it is the place you've always wanted to go. If they give you such a small startup that you just know you're not going to be able to be successful, then you have to be really clear about that, because you don't want to even go to your dream job and not have what you need to be successful in that dream job.
Absolutely. And that can be really hard to figure out when you're first starting, is what do I need to be successful? Because I've never done this before. I've never had an assistant professor position before. So I know for me, talking with my mentor, someone that did the same kind of research that I am doing and want to continue doing, I know that was really helpful. Is there anything else you would advise for how to figure out what you might need to be successful?
I really think it really is key to talk to your mentor and to your colleagues. You can also think about just take a stab at writing your grant application. So you have to write, if you're wanting to submit a grant in the future, you'll have to write your facilities and resources section. So you can think about an outline of what you want your facilities and resource section to look like for the grants that you're going to write. And if it doesn't, if you look at it, you're like, this just doesn't look good. It's not compelling for my grant applications. Then that's a sign. And you want to think about your first grant. So think about, if you were getting your first grant, what would be the things that you would need to accomplish the first goals that you have in mind for your research? What are those goals? What would you need to accomplish those goals? For instance, the testing materials that you need, and the research associates that you need to process data, because there might be a lot of data processing, the equipment, the software, all of those kinds of things that you need in place. You want to think about that. And then that's what would be ideally what you would receive for your startup funds, is essentially treat that like a first grant that you'd receive to do that, those first critically important steps in your research. And that helps you to get prepared, because you have to be really, really prepared. So getting prepared, thinking like writing a grant, and then talking to people consistently talking to people. One of the best pieces of advice I got when I was first negotiating, this was for the second job, because as I said, I did not negotiate for the first job. When I was negotiating for the second job, someone told me, don't think like a peon, think like a PI, because that's principal investigator for a grant. So really be thinking about, what do you want to have in place for your lab?
Yeah, that's so helpful. Thank you. That's great advice. I think it can be challenging to get yourself in that mindset as you're just finishing your PhD and you're balancing all of these other things with your dissertation. But yeah, being able to really think through, how can I be successful? What am I going to need? And now is the time to advocate for those things so that you can be successful as you get yourself started.
You're really never as powerful in negotiations as you are right there in that time when you've received that initial offer and it's being formulated. Once you sign the offer, you really have lost negotiation power, and you've probably lost it for quite some time. At that point, the chair, whoever made the offer, the dean, they're going to say, okay, she's all set. Or he's all set. They're going to assume that you've asked for what you need and that you're happy with what you have and that you can get the work done. So if you take an offer and then let's say, midway through the first year, you go back and say, I need, $50,000 more. They're going to be a little frustrated because they're going to say, well, I already did the best I could to negotiate the offer that you said you needed. So you definitely want to be upfront. Even if you don't get what you've asked for, at least you've made it clear what you need. So then if you don't get the full startup, for instance, then you could go to your chair and say, I didn't get my full startup. This is what I've done so far. I just want to, work with you to see if there are any additional funds for new investigators in the Institute, or as I, work forward towards my grant. You just want to be very clear up front.
Yes, absolutely. The other thing that I think people wonder about is, how do you navigate negotiating for several different positions, two or three positions at once? And how much to share about that, the fact that you are navigating negotiating multiple different positions, if you should share anything about that with the other institution, or if you should really keep that private. What kind of advice do you have for how to go about that?
Now, I tend to take the stance that you should be as open as possible. If anything, it's going to help you in your negotiation, because you want to make clear that, let's say you have two offers, you could just say to the, to one person, say, I have another offer I'm considering. And the other person will say, I have another offer. And it's not unusual to do that. And in some ways, it almost makes you more competitive, because they're like, oh, this person is wanted by multiple institutions, I'm going to work even harder. And you can really be clear about what's being offered. So I had a situation where I had, two offers at once, and I was clear with both of them. I was actually leaning towards the place that had a little lower salary, but that was for personal reasons. That's really where I wanted to be. But I did tell them, I have this other offer, and this is what they're offering me salary-wise. Can you match that salary? And that's okay. You're not really... Sometimes it gets a bad rap, like, oh, you're playing them against each other. But that's really not the key here. The key is that you want to be honest. You want to be open. You want to get the best offer for yourself and for your research. And it's helpful also to be open with them, because timeline really factors in. So you may be told, I need you to work through this, and can you accept this offer in a week? But you may be waiting on another soft offer. So you've been working with someone else and they say, we're putting together a package for you. Then you would want to tell the person, I'm waiting on another offer, so I request you to give me an extra week. Now, from the side of the institute, the time is of essence for them, because if they have three applications and maybe you're the first person they've offered it to, but they really like the other two applicants and they don't want to lose them, they may put time pressure on you. So I think that's a really tricky part when you're negotiating multiple offers is, again, the transparency, but also the timing of it can be really tricky.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's okay to ask for extra time in that process if you feel like you need it.
Yes, absolutely. And it's okay to be transparent about getting multiple offers or waiting on a different offer. I think the key is that you want to always ensure that the person you're speaking with knows that their institute is one of your top choices.
Yeah, and using that language and being very clear about that, I think it's important. Mm-hmm. What are some things you would say to avoid doing when negotiating? Are there any common negotiation mistakes maybe that you've done or you've seen being on search committees?
I think one of the biggest mistakes people make is they don't do their homework. So they ask for things that are just not within reach of that institution. So for instance, if you were working with a teaching institution and you come in, you say, I want 80% time for research. It can really put doubt into the person making the offer to you, because they start to think, does this person know the institute that they're applying to? Do they have a sense of what we do? It can cast a lot of doubt for your competence if you go in and you haven't done your homework, or if you are going into a place that is maybe a smaller place and you ask for $500,000 startup funds and they're like, we've never done that. That's just absolutely ridiculous. So I think it's just really doing your homework the very best you can is really the key, because the biggest mistake that you can make is coming in with a request that is just completely outside of the possibility for that institution. And if you do that, though, by the way, it can happen, you will be able to tell pretty quickly. And then I think you can do some repair work, so if you ask for I think startups are the hardest, to be honest, because it's hard to do research on startups. You have to kind of really hear through the grapevine, I guess. Like, you have to kind of really think about it a little bit, maybe talk to people that have been there before. I think you can also, to help do your homework and not make these mistakes, you can also ask very good questions in your interview. So you can ask in your interview, what is a typical startup package, in terms of finances? So then you can have a bit of a range, so that you're not, asking for something that's just completely out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah, I think that's a great thing to ask. And that way, going into it, and you can look at your startup spreadsheet that you've prepared and see, can I add something? Do I need to take something off? What is really reasonable for this institution?
Mm-hmm. I think the other thing too, that in terms of mistakes with negotiating, the number one mistake is not negotiating. That's the number one mistake. Yeah. So always negotiate. The second mistake I think is just being, not doing your homework. So you're really out of the, you know, range of possibility, and it's not good. I think the third mistake can be feeling pressure. So not giving yourself space to do the due diligence. So for instance, maybe you get a phone call and you feel that pressure to say something. So you have the right, again, as we discussed, to ask for some time. But even if they say, well, I'd really like you to let me know tomorrow, another mistake you can make is not reaching out to your network, because you might think, I don't want to reach out to my network because that's so little time. Like, I don't want to, you know, put pressure on my mentor because, you know, I'm asking them to call me tomorrow. You can always ask, because mentors know how timely negotiations are and offers are. So if a past student of mine calls and says, or, you know, gives me a message that says, hey, I've been made this offer, can you talk for 15 minutes? I will make time for that because it is a timely situation, but they may feel like I don't even want to ask you because of the time. So always, always reach out to your support network, regardless of the amount of time you have.
Definitely. They're willing to help. That was the same from my experience too. It's like they want you to get the most support that you can to get off to a strong start. So don't be afraid to reach out to them.
Yes, definitely.
I'm curious what advice you have for declining an offer. So after you've gone through this process, you really get to know the people that you're negotiating with, the people in the department, and then you have to make a decision. And what would you say, how to approach declining an offer if it really is just not the best fit for you?
That's a really hard one. And I've had to decline offers before, and you always feel just, I don't know, like you said, you get close to the people, you know, and you build this relationship in a short period of time, and you feel bad, like you're letting them down. But I think ultimately you have to be true to yourself. And the best thing to do is to be as honest as possible. So let's say you're negotiating and ultimately you decide that this is just not a good location for you for who knows what reasons. I think you could say that. You can say, you know what, I did my due diligence and this just isn't going to, you could say the offer's great. I appreciate all that you've done. Ultimately, this is not the best move at this time for my family, me and my family. And you don't have to elaborate on that. And if you're a single person, your family is you and your extended family. You don't have to be partnered up to say that this is not good for you and your family. So you have to be thinking about ultimately what is the right move long term. And so I think being as honest as you can is the best thing you can do. Or if you say, you know, sometimes what you'll do is you'll negotiate and then you realize, I kind of want to stay in my postdoc, actually. My postdoc is, you know, has some great things to offer. That can feel even more, you know, hard because you're not even moving somewhere. You're not taking a different offer. But I think, again, you have to be just very honest and say that this has been a great process. And, you know, you really appreciated getting to know them and their institution, but you've decided that there are some amazing opportunities that you need to take advantage of in your postdoc at this time. So you're going to be staying in the position. The other thing too is, so be honest. The second thing is let them know as soon as possible. So if you're negotiating and something happens and you're just like, I know I'm not going to take this offer. You just want to tell them right then, because you don't want them to put all this time and effort into putting together an offer letter and a package and doing negotiation on their end with their dean and spending time. If you know you don't want to go, just tell them right up front. Say, you know what, I'm going to actually stop this discussion because I know I'm not going to be coming to this position. I'd rather tell you now before you put time into it, and you can explain why.
Yeah, definitely. And they have their own timelines, like you mentioned earlier. So I think that's just being respectful, just letting them know as soon as you know. Do you think this should be done in a phone call or an email?
I think the most personal way is better, and you'll know at that point what the person prefers. Some people are actually pretty clear that they prefer email correspondence, but I think if you can, giving a phone call or setting up a Zoom is probably the best way, because you're getting a little bit more personalized. Even though that's the harder way, I think it's the more honorable way to tell the person.
And would you recommend the same if you are going to accept the offer on the other side of things?
Yeah, I think so. Both of them, I think, require more of a personal touch. And so either way, if you can get them on Zoom or on a phone call, for either of them, I think it's fantastic. And then you'd want to follow up with an email as well.
All right. Any last advice here before we go to our rapid fire questions to wrap up for negotiating for your first position?
Yes. One thing I want to say is that you always want to get everything in writing. So you're going to go through your negotiation process and then you'll, you know, receive, let's say you receive an offer letter and you start negotiating. Whatever you negotiate, you need a new offer letter that reflects exactly what you've negotiated. And if possible, you want every single thing in writing. So if they say to you, all first-year professors get a GA for their class, and then they don't put it in the offer letter, you can very clearly and kindly say you would like that to be included in the offer letter. So everything you've discussed needs to be in the offer letter, even if it requires slight tweaking before you sign it. Because once you sign it, the negotiation is over. And you can't go back and say, hey, you know, you said this, or I want this. And this is really important because one position I went to, for instance, and this happens quite a bit, is I negotiated with one chair. And then by the time I got there, there was a new chair. And the old chair had said, oh, you get XYZ, but it wasn't in the offer letter. And the new chair, when I met with them and said, well, this old chair said I could have this. They're like, well, that's not how we do it. It's not in writing. So it's not that they didn't want to give it to me, but that was something that was not negotiated by them and they didn't see how they could get that for me. So everything needs to be in writing and don't hesitate to ask for it in writing.
Yes, yes, absolutely. That's so important. And keep a copy of that. Make sure you don't lose it. Print it out. Save it on your computer. Just make sure that you have all that information in writing. All right, let's go to our rapid fire questions here. Thank you so much for all of this wisdom that you've just shared about the negotiation process. It's so helpful to hear the kinds of words to say, the kinds of language to use, and the kinds of things to be thinking about because it is such a different process for negotiation.
Thank you again for having this important discussion.
Absolutely. All right. My first rapid fire question that I ask all my guests is, what is one resource that you couldn't live without?
I love the book Crucial Conversations. I think it has made me a better mentor and a better instructor and just a better human, actually. And this, they have two different books. One is Crucial Conversations and one is Crucial Conversations for Work. I think they're both amazing. They give you the language to have the tough conversations that you have to have in your life to create positive relationships, to set standards in your lab and your work. So Crucial Conversations is something that a resource that I just love.
Thank you for sharing that. I will have to look into it. What has been a defining moment in your academic journey?
When I think about a defining moment, it was for me when I received my first grant, where I was the principal investigator. It was a small grant from NIH. It was the R03, which was the R21, now early career. And it just felt like a moment where I thought, okay, I had the bit of the I've made it mode in terms of research. And that was a really strong defining moment for me.
Oh, that's great. That sounds very exciting. What is one thing on your professional bucket list? You've done so much already, but what's left on your professional bucket list?
One thing I'm really wanting to do is to create a community and a resource for implementation science in our field. I think that, as I've been in this career for some time now, just seeing the gap between research and practice, I'd really like to set up some type of resource and system and community to reduce that gap. And in particular, my goal is to support junior investigators as they're embarking on their career to realize that they are in the, they're in the driver's seat and they can include components around research to practice getting voices heard from the community early on in the research process. And they can think creatively about how they can publish that work. And I hope I can be in a position to help the new generation as they do that, and anyone really who's interested in approaching and thinking through implementation science.
And you've done so much great work in this space already, but I look forward to seeing what's next.
Thank you.
What has been your favorite part about your job as a professor and a scientist in our field?
My favorite part has been to mentor students. So I learn just as much from my students as they learn from me. I think that it's keeps me fresh. It feels like it keeps me young. It keeps me humble. It's just such an honor to work with so many amazing junior investigators and early stage clinicians at all levels to help them to accomplish their goals. And that's just a big highlight for me and something I love.
That is great. How can people connect with you or learn more about you and your work?
Well, I think right now it probably the best place is on Twitter. I do try to keep up there and post some things. I have a love-hate relationship with social media. I try really hard to keep up to date on it, but it can be tricky, as we all know, for so many reasons. But also, I'll say that anyone who wants to reach out to me can on email. I think that, you know, I do my very best to respond to anyone that reaches out for any reason. So keeping up probably best on social media, and I probably do the most on Twitter, but I think that in terms of reaching me, don't hesitate to send an email.
And I'll put all your social media links in the show notes, as well as your podcast, See Hear Speak podcast. Do you want to mention anything about that before we go?
Oh, yes. Yeah, yes. So I do have a podcast, and it's something that I do as a hobby. And it's a real honor to talk to lots of different persons who are interested in speech language and literacy, and to kind of just have some really honest conversations with them and share that out for the world. And I do it, you know, pretty haphazardly, but it's been fun, and I've done it since 2018. So it's been pretty consistent. And then I also have a website with others led by Carla McGregor called DLD and Me, which is a repository of information about developmental language disorder that we've been working on for some time as well. So that's another information source that I'll shout out about that we consistently update as well.
Both are just amazing resources. I share them with my students all the time. And so I'll be sure to put all that information in the show notes. Thank you so much for all of your work in our field, as well as all of this great information that you shared today. I know it's going to be a great resource for many that are on the job market this year and years to come. So thank you again so much for your time.
Thank you again for having me.
Thank you for tuning in for another episode of About, From, and With. If you haven't already, be sure to follow the podcast so you'll be notified of new episodes when they come out. I'd also love if you could take a quick second to leave a review of the podcast to help others find it. You can follow me in the podcast on Instagram at danicapeifer.slp or on Twitter at about from_with. Until next time, stay humble and kind.